Hello, I'm Will Shires and this is Talking Trucks. In this episode, I'm joined by the Road Haulage Association's MD, Richard Smith, who'll be answering commercial motor reader questions over a fry-up at the Junction 23 lorry park. Hello, Richard. Thank you for joining me.
Good morning, Will. Thank you very much for the invitation and the lovely breakfast.
Glad you enjoyed it. And I'm also glad you didn't ask for avocados on toast or bran flakes or any of that nonsense.
No. We're coming to a breakfast. I've been looking forward to this for about 2 or 3 weeks, actually. In fact, I starved myself last night to enjoy it.
Good stuff. And we both went for the, what was it, the big breakfast, wasn't it?
The Gut Buster.
Good stuff. Right, now, we've been inundated with reader questions for you. So first of all, apologies to anyone out there who sent a question in that I'm not going to ask. It's because we had so many of them. Why do you think so many people had questions for you?
I mean, I think it's not me as a person, it's the RHA. You know, and it's obviously, never has there been more of a critical time. And it's been recognised that, you know, 85% of what arrives in your room, my room, in this calf, of what we've just eaten, goes on a truck at some point during that journey in the logistics chain. And it's at a time where margins are tight, where the structural changes, as I describe them, are occurring in the industry. So we've got skills challenge, drivers, mechanics, office staff, managers, the next generation. We've got the decarbonisation conversation and what that means to us. And we've got the changing manufacturers and retailers' habits, which is meaning, for example, 25 years ago, all Amazon did was sell books. Now they provide most of what we have in our houses, I would suggest.
Yeah.
Woolworths was a shop that used to exist. And those changes all impact the industry. So to answer your question directly, I think the readers are aware of the changes and challenges. They want to discuss, debate that, and understand our position and be clear on what we're doing as the largest trade association representing this industry.
Okay. Yeah, so on that subject, just in case there's any readers, any listeners who don't know what the RHA is all about, let's see your best elevator pitch. Tell us what it's all about.
Okay. So the RHA was born, as I describe it, in 1945. So it's over 80 years old now. And it was, and I think this is quite important, Will. The reason why it came into existence was when the nationalised transport industry was turned back to private ownership. And it was that governance support structure that I guess back then they were looking for. And we've really carried on doing that. So today we stand with 8,500 members. We represent over 60% of the commercial vehicles on the road. We have a coach membership as well as a HGV membership and a van membership. And that reflects really the way that those sectors have changed and emerged to actually have the same challenges and the same needs from consumer line. In terms of, as an association, we are the largest dedicated trade association. We have six pillars. And we have six set of values and we have six priorities. I think that's really important. So during the course of the questions, if I've not unpacked the pillars, the priorities and the values, you know, we'll come back to that at the end because it gives us a direction, a purpose. And the questions that we will be asked is, what do you do for the industry? What do you do for me? And they're all very valid questions. And I think one of the biggest challenges we as a trade association have going forward is we don't tell people enough what we do.
Okay, brilliant. So first question, this is one we ask all the truck manufacturer MDs whenever we do one of these grilled in the cabs.
Yeah.
Do you have an HGV licence? And if not, do you think it matters?
No, nope, I ain't got an HGV licence because I don't have the skill set, the professionalism or the mindset to be a professional driver. People hear me say this and I say it quite a lot. And I spent quite a bit of time in Europe in previous lives. Driving a truck is a profession. It's a skill. And to me, it's like being an accountant. Might be a inspector or a legal person. You train to do that. You know, you dedicate yourself in doing that. And you're driving around, if it's an Arctic in a 44-ton bullet, you know, and there's more requirements, regulatory requirements on you than there is flying a plane. All those things are facts. I do not have that skill set. I have driven a truck on private land, so I understand how it moves. You know, I couldn't drive on the road. You know, articulated vehicles are very different to driving vans and they're very different to driving cars. And I think we should respect that. Does it affect my ability to run the RHA? No, because the truck is a key component of what we represent. But actually, the RHA is not an expert on trucks. That's the manufacturers. That's yourself, your publications. You're far more knowledgeable on trucks and the latest technology and the update. The truck is part of the process. And what I have done for 35 years is run logistics businesses across Europe. You know, so I've run organisations where there's been 300-400 trucks with warehousing associated, automated warehousing, manual warehousing, chilled warehousing, frozen warehousing. But I've always had drivers there as well, you know, and I've spent a lot of time engaging with the drivers. And in fact, when I used to run a general site, so we'd have the warehouse and we'd have the driving, I used to love going in and saying in the smoke room, because I used to smoke in those days, which one of you is more important, the driver or the warehouse person? And it was always a lively debate. So hopefully that answers the question. It actually allows me to have a more holistic view to run the organisation rather than the driver. We're not a trade union, we're a trade association. So I think that keeps it balanced.
Yeah, okay. Right, I think you've kind of answered the next question with your CV there. This guy said, I've been in haulage all my life. Why is it you're representing me at government level?
Yeah, it's a really good answer. And I always, I think I'm very lucky to do what I do. You know, and if the person that asked the question could see me now, he'd probably see quite a little smile on my face. Because every day, I think, you know, it's almost like a privilege to do his job. And that's not me saying that from some sort of twee way of doing things. I'm a great example of social mobility, and this is why people should come into this industry. Now, people talk about careers in the legal world, they talk about medicine, all very good, valid professions. But if you want to come into an industry and not know what you want to do, and develop your skills and find a job you enjoy, come into logistics, come into warehousing, come into transport. And I started off working on a production line when I'd left university and done other stuff. So about 23, 24. And one day, the ops director came across and said, one of the lads in the warehouse, because they're the smaller ones, has phoned in sick. Would you mind loading that truck? And it was a company called Banners of Dudley, and it was all flats. Yeah. I don't know if they're still going, actually. So I went across, and I got on the truck, and it was, I'll say this caveat to it, it was before health and safety was as stringently complied with as it is today.
Yeah.
So I practiced for half an hour in the car park driving the forklift truck, and it took me 4.5 hours to put 24 pallets on this flat because I was driving it like a car. I didn't know what the dead man was. And the driver was one of the most pleasant people. He's on a night out, so he didn't really care. And the one condition was I had to help him rope and sheet it afterwards because it was a flat. Yeah, and that was my entry into it. And I remember getting off the truck, the forklift truck, saying, I'm never doing this again. You know, and then from then, I went to work for TDG. And that's where I learned my transport planning. So I ran a desk and we had general fleet, we had a dedicated fleet, and we had wagon and drags back in the day. Then I got into the warehousing again. So my career is, I went in Canton, I worked in Italy, I've done private public business. So it came to the, how did it end up being the RHA? And all through my career, operationally, I never really engaged with the RHA. I never really engaged with the Logistics UK or anybody really, because it was always the transport manager would do that, and they would be reporting into me through my structure. So when I joined, it was to do the truck cartel legal action. And the reason why I joined to do that was it was a one-off lifetime opportunity to actually get compensation for the industry. You know, not to prove people right or wrong, to get compensation. And it was a business process. So I'm a business person that runs a trade association. I'm an operator that runs a trade association, which makes me very different to other CEOs. And this is why I call myself an MD, which I'm quite happy to explain that. So I was then asked 4 years ago to run the organisation when the previous CEO left, and my initial thoughts was, I'm not going to do that, you know, because it's not a business process and I can't support the industry like it needs the support. And policy was something I'd never done, and advocacy. And my impression then was, no, it's not me. But actually, I agreed to do it on a trial, and if it didn't work out, we'd part company. But when I started doing the policy side, it's just like a business process. As long as it's evidence-based, as long as it's factual, I'm trying to convince people on behalf of somebody else to use this service or listen to me, which is just like trying to sell somebody something.
Yeah.
So hopefully that answers the question. I stumbled into running the RHA, but I do it on years of experience and knowledge that I've gained, but I'm not an expert. Does that answer the question?
It does. So tell me, out of everyone on your phone, who's the most influential person you can call? And when it comes to politicians, are they ever ringing you, or is it always you doing the chasing?
Yeah, most influential person on, there's a couple probably on my phone. One is, God bless my mum, and I'm not just saying that, because, you know, I come from a very small family. It's the Yorkshire family, so, yeah, my mum's the boss, that's it. You know, so I'll ring my mum every day, and I'll go and see her at least once a week. That's just what I do. I'll answer the policy one. It's a bit of both. Yes, I have phone numbers for politicians. I'm not going to particularly go into which ones I do. But it's actually the departments and the civil servants that I will spend 80% of my time talking to, you know, because they are the equivalent of me, you know. So I provide the information, the evidence. I have regular weekly calls with DFT, DBT, you know, with the Treasury, with the Cabinet Office, etc., etc. And the one thing we've become particular, so I've got all their civil servants' phone numbers and contact details. One thing we have done very well in the last 4 years is we're a lot broader. Now, as a trade association, we don't just engage with DFT. We engage across all government departments because the industry is made up of businesses as well as hauliers and truckers. You know, and it's important that if you look at April this year, with all the changes that are going to occur, yes, we've got some haulier-specific things, you know, but we've also got business things, and we've got minimum wage, and we've got all this, which is becoming more integrated. So, yes, I mean, if I need to make representation to any Secretary of State in this country, I can do so within a few hours.
Brilliant. Okay. When was the last time someone in government actually surprised you by being really understanding with
last
all
week? It was last week. And it was at our parliamentary event. And it didn't really surprise me. So young Keir Mathea, I think is how you say his surname. Apologies, Keir, if you're listening. Met with him a couple of times. And I think he must be one of the youngest ministers. He's only 26, 27. MP for Selby, you know, and he's got 20 of our members in his constituency. And I met him, and his enthusiasm to understand the detail was immense. And he said to me after one of the meetings, you know, Richard, I really want to get into this industry, you understand it, and everything else. I said, well, come to our parliamentary reception, which he did, open it up. And I think the 220 people that were there, including other trade bodies, would share the same view that he's genuinely interested, you know, and he's trying to learn and understand it. And he does understand the impact. He does understand we're going through structural change. He does understand that we need to look at moving freight differently. He does understand, you know, that the infrastructure is crumbling around us and is not fit for purpose. He's been to France, he's been to Italy, he's been to other European countries and looked at the facilities drivers have over there, and he understands that, and genuinely does. The challenge, and I'm saying it with a smile on my face, is probably a lot of the questions we'll be asked later on. What really can he do about that? Because he ain't got any money, you know, to spend. It can affect legislation and regulation, which is important, and he's picked up on that point. So the other one as well, Simon Lightwood, who is the Roads Minister, exactly the same. New to the industry, he gets it, you know, he understands the challenges. Being very supportive from a coach membership perspective, of recognising coaches being different to buses, etc., etc. And they understand the trucks as well. So both the ministers actually are very good.
Good, yeah, great to hear. So from where I sit, it's hard to know where the RHA actually has influence.
Yep.
Where can you really make things happen?
Yep.
Where are your hands tied? And what's been your most frustrating conversation with government in the past year?
There's three questions, though. You asked me one time. So we make... I've referenced it earlier on, is... Every month, every week, I'll sit down and say to the team, the senior team, so the six people that, you know, saying, is what have we done? What have we done? You know, what can I go home and tell my wife and my friends, this is a good day at the RHA? And, you know, I'll go to a specific example, and I've probably got about 24, 25 of these across the four nations we represent. Okay? So we've obviously got England, we've got Wales, we've got Scotland, we've got Northern Ireland. You know, a year ago, we didn't really understand the challenges of the Windsor Framework in and out of Northern Ireland. Not many people did, if I'm being candid. People just spoke around it. Last week, we were given evidence for the third time in front of a select committee on the issues and the challenges, and also in the House of Lords, against the News Collect Committee, making the points. We are now having conversations around the Trusted Trader Scheme and looking at potential different amendments and changes we can make to suit the industry. Okay. Now, that is one example. You wouldn't notice that unless you followed me on social media. DVS in London, 18 months ago, we got the extension of 3 months. Yes, it was only 3 months. We got Dr. Steve, I can't remember his surname, to come down and explain to the industry what the standard was they had to have to fit to the vehicle. And we did that at an event at Peterborough, and we invited all the industry. You know, so those two examples. Up in Scotland, we've been campaigning for 5 years to get the speed limit lifted to 50 miles an hour. That was successful. So unfortunately, and this is a big learning for me, Will, in policy, because business is a very immediate thing. You either deliver your load on time or you don't. You either make money or you don't. When you do the policy, it's about that longer strategic plan, because You have to accept you're probably not going to get what you want, and that's not a defeated person talk, because life changes and it's going to take a long time. Scotland, 50 mile an hour, an example. DVS extension, the industry understood it, and they weren't getting ripped off because there was a lack of a standard there, shall we say. Manchester, a few years ago, the zero emission zone, we were the reason why it wasn't introduced behind the burner. Yeah, so it was rolled. Bath, we got an extension. So there's so very, very many. In terms of, ask me the other question, sorry, it was about frustration, I think.
Yeah, what's been your most frustrating conversation with government in the past year?
I'll go the last two or three weeks, 1980. You know, so the EES, since our EES has been implemented, and it means that now the 1980 rule can be enforced, and that will lead, and it's already started, to jobs being lost in the industry of UK-based drivers, and if particularly events, businesses, or coach operators, if they want to carry on operating, they have to employ European drivers. You know, my question, which I asked the Chancellor last Friday, if I met the Chancellor last Friday, factual, it's not name-dropping, is we are concerned about the international supply chain resilience in and out of this country into Europe, particularly at a time when we're looking to encourage growth, particularly with the SMEs. We are going to be at the hands of European hauliers deciding when, what day, what price, and when goods move out of this country if we end up with no international UK-based haulage business. I found that very frustrating. Everybody understands the issue. We've got buying from the government departments, but they can't influence it because it's an EU decision as part of the reset. So that will, hopefully we'll get an easement or just a 12-month stay of execution from the EU, but that is reliant upon the government departments lobbying on our behalf. We've gone directly to the EU, and we're using the AIU as well to support us on that. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, I think so. Established family-run firms are still going bust and margins are tight. Why shouldn't I cancel my OHA membership and keep the cash? What tangible protection or value do I actually get?
Yeah, and this is a question I get asked quite a lot. So I spend quite a lot of my time. I think it's important as the MD visiting a lot of the members who fall into this scale. You know, last year, for the previous three years, there's been record levels of businesses going into insolvency, as you're aware. And that's doubled from 4 years ago. So it's significantly stepped up after COVID. This year we saw a slight slowing, so it's about a 20% reduction. And it's still twice as much as it was in 2021. Okay, so there is a structural change going on in the industry, yeah, as I would call it. It's not just family businesses in this space that are changing. If you speak to FSB, Federation of Small Businesses, which is an organisation we collaborate with, it's across the board. So that whether it be florists, plumbers, electricians, there is a significant change. To come back to the specific question, why should cancel the membership? I understand why people cancel the membership. You know, the biggest reason, 95% of the people leave the RHA because of financial reasons. So either they've gone into administration, or they're going into insolvency, or they can't afford to pay if they were one truck operator, 420 quid, yeah, £1.15 a day. So if they're that challenged, I understand totally why. To answer the other question, why should you stay in? I can't protect your business. I can't tell you how to run your business as the RHA, but I can give you a network and a community to knowledge, advice, and guidance, you know, on the day-to-day technical side of it. And also I give you the voice that I've described previously, which allows us to demonstrate to policymakers. An interesting thing is, it's not just Westminster in England. You know, it's not just the chimes of Big Ben, it's the devolved powers, so it's the Metro Mayors. So I was with Richard Parker last week as well, actually, West Midlands Combined Authority Mayor, and he's now got the authority and the money to actually invest in training in his area. So it's actually knowing where to go as well. We do that on your behalf as the industry. We don't tell you we're doing it every day, because it's our job. You know, I would encourage anybody who is thinking of leaving the RHA is to, you know, not you can speak to me if you want, you're very welcome to do, but realistically speak to a member of the team and just remind yourself of what value we do actually give you. And I'm very happy to be challenged on your perception of that as well.
Okay, this one's quite similar. As a one truck operator, what would be the annual fee to join the RHA, and what benefits would I get?
Okay, so it's £420, £1.15 a day. I always break things down into a day rate. It goes back to being an operator. And I would say there's three things. One is you get to be part of the RHA community. 8,500 businesses, over 6% of the fleets on the road. The knowledge, the experience, the learnings, the infrastructure. So we have regional briefs. We have a help desk, which is all you can ring at any time and ask any question. We've got area managers based in the actual region who we can see or speak to or just text and ask them any questions and concerns on a day-to-day technical operational perspective. You also get industry insights for our communication, so where the industry is going. So if you're looking to grow your business, to stay as you are or to protect your business, you will be regularly updated about the road to net zero, technical changes, skills challenges, and give you access to, I'll give you a good example. If there's funding available, particularly around the battery electric, and you're an operator who's got electric trucks, we will support you to make that application, et cetera, et cetera. So it's that network and that connection thing. And also, you're part of the industry representative body that is recognised by key stakeholders, not just government, national and regional, but actually, whether it be truck manufacturers, whether it be other agencies, they recognise the RHO. So one of our biggest strengths, is the clue's in the title. What does Road Haulage Association do? The clue is in the title. So it makes us very identifiable. So you get all of that for £1.15 a day if you go on truck.
So we just touched on the current climate with operators going under. Someone asks here, if you could change one regulation overnight to help operators survive over the next few years, what would it be? It's a tricky one.
Does a budget announcement count as a regulation? If it does,
I'll give you this one.
So the fuel duty. Okay, the 5p is coming back in September this year, 26, I think it is. But to then get it to float from April 27 with RPI is, and this point was made to the Chancellor last week as well, is suicide. It's suicide for the industry and for the economy. Because what you'll do is drive inflation in, and you're driving cost inflation. And that does two things to this industry, which is the point around we are a lot more than just trucks and coaches, and that's why we're as integrated now with the Department for Business, because we're a key economic enabler. We did a survey just before last year's budget, as a sense check, the mood of the industry, as we call it, to feed into government. And the biggest concern from the members wasn't the fuel duty, because most people have escalators and the ability to pass through. It was, will their customers still need their services after all the other changes that's going around them? So they're very much aware now of the economic impact. So the manufacturer down the road, rather than a load every day, it might be one load every other day. Our businesses, this morning I read in the press on the way up actually, the FSB is just in a really good piece of research saying that potentially from April, one in three small businesses will shut the doors or reduce production. That worries our membership. So if I could change one thing, I'd roll back that linking it to RPI. I think we have to accept the 5p because that was put on with the Ukrainian war, and the fuel price. And again, people say to me, what's the RHA do? We're one of the reasons why fuel duty was held from 2012. Not just exclusively, because collaboration is really important to us as a trade body, because there is no one trade association in this country that can influence directly our one body. So you have to work across your lines and you have to create a voice of relevance where it's needed. So I'd change that from an actual technical perspective. It's not a piece of regulation that I would change. It's one that I would look at and address is around the van. Okay, so we've just bought a Renault Master electric to put our simulator in the back of, and it's exactly the same size van as the diesel equivalent I've got, but it's got a battery. So now I'm on the taco, so now I'm restricted at 56 miles an hour. That is not good for this industry, and that is not good to, that is suppressing people that convert. So now I'm putting all those vans onto the inside lane on the motorway, so now I'm causing all that congestion. Although I don't drive a truck, I understand the difference between driving. I can put my foot down in my car in the right area and just move out of problems. You can't drive in the vehicle. You have to preempt it, you have to understand it, you have to almost second guess it. So you're putting people who are used to driving vans, doing what I do, putting the foot down going, all of a sudden they're in the queue. That cannot be safe as well. So if that answers the question.
Yeah, good answer. So when you tell people outside the industry what you do, what do they usually get completely wrong about road haulage?
They think it's a Royal Horticultural Association, some of them. so they think I'm into plants, what do they usually get wrong? They don't recognise the breadth and the depth of what we do as an organisation, which comes back to the six pillars. So the six pillars that hold up the roof of the RHA, if you imagine it as a name. We are obviously a membership-led trade association. So that's the pillar in the bottom right-hand corner as I visualise them. We also employ 115 people. So we're actually quite, we're bigger than most people in this industry as an employer. Turnover £15 million. So we're a bigger, you can see it's in our accounts. 10 million comes from commercial activity, which has grown in the last 5 or 6 years and is all relevant and competitive for this industry. So I don't do things that are in the industry to support the membership. 5 million comes from membership. You know, one of the other pillars that we've got is campaigning, obviously, lobbying policy. The other one is brand, because we are a brand. And then we've got a finance function as well. So actually, when I explain what it is to be a trade association, that's quite surprising to people. But actually, to answer your question directly, what they don't realise about the RHA is the industry representative and how important it is to their day-to-day lives. That's the big thing.
Okay.
You know, again, that breakfast, which was lovely, 85% of it's come on a truck. In fact, probably all of that's come on a truck.
Yeah.
You know, and they then start to go, oh. And when you give it a context, and say, just imagine if Amazon did turn up, or if you couldn't order your Starbucks with the Uber person turning up, what would happen then? Because it's not the person who's the limit to your door, everything that sits in front of it, as you well know, it's about that supply chain.
Okay. Do you think the RHA sometimes worries too much about staying polite with government instead of being properly angry on behalf of operators?
It's an interesting one, this, Will. And I get asked this question quite a lot, and I understand it totally. So if I was to walk around this room and have a cup of tea with the guys, I get it, you know, they'd want me to be banging the table and kicking doors down, and I totally get it, you know, I'm used to engaging and speaking and working with drivers, so that audience, I get it. The reality is if we do that, nobody listens, that is reality, and it's all about evidence-based, factual arguments, if that makes sense, which are frustrating, which take a long time to produce, which people don't realise, and I understand that, because I always look at it from that thinking. Yeah, but the way you will win the argument and convince and influence people, I'll go back to the DVS, which is a really good example. So we sat there with, you know, Will Norman, Seb Dance, you know, and all the TFL. And basically the reason why they extended is one is realised that the information they put out nobody could understand because they were engineers, you know, they were operators of trucks. But the other one was that the 210,000 vehicles that went into London over a 12-month period delivering the croissants and the coffee and everything else wouldn't be there. That was the reason. So I didn't go on national press about that and cause a driver shortage or a run on croissants in the local press. We did it through demonstrated reasonable argument. And in fairness, David Wells and Lucas UK were very supportive in that process as well. So that is a proven way to do it. But I understand totally, you want to see us. It's a bit like when you're watching a boxing match. Do you want to watch a boxer who's got a knockout punch or somebody that's got a good jab?
Yeah.
It's that sort of way. You know, I'd always go for the jab, but I get the punch.
Yeah, yeah, good. Okay. The RH, we touched on the cartel earlier. Right, got a question about that then. The RHA is leading the cartel claim against truck manufacturers. It's been ongoing for a number of years and has lost traction to the point that it isn't even talked about. Yep. What are the chances of anyone getting their money back and what's the timescale?
Okay, so I did a fantastic podcast, you know, which was released in December. So your listeners and your readers, if you go on YouTube, you'll see it. Roadway, the podcast, I think it's called. We've just launched it. And that was myself and Stephen Maroff from Backhouse Jones, who is the lead legal person on this with me, answering questions from our FD, Abby, which is great. And if you listen to that, I answer all these questions. I will unpack a little bit now. So I expect a result on the cartel within the next 12 months.
Oh, really? The next 12 months?
And the reason why you don't see what's going on is because obviously it's the biggest legal type of its type ever brought in Europe for the cartelistic, you know, activity. Yeah, it's got the potential of being a multi hundreds of million pound settlement, which will be bigger than any other settlements that have been made, because settlements have been made for this activity by the OEMs, which is in the public domain. Okay, we've had to set a number of precedents. Okay, so the reason why it's taken so long is the manufacturers have fought it very hard, and I'm on record as saying this. And I get that, because if I was them, I'd be fighting it hard as well. Because they're trying to slow it down, they're trying to get us to run out of money, and they're trying to go for a nutrition, which is common in this case. And that's not me, you know, making slight of any of the MDs or any of the CEOs that are involved with the OEMs. I would do that. You're defending your position, totally understand it. Also, in the middle of it, we had to renegotiate the funding because a judgment was given around the validity of what they call the DBA funding, you know, so we had to renegotiate that. And then we had to get the CPO to go through the country. We were the first organisation ever to get granted the CPO. and that is precedent setting. So because of all the precedents, because of the way it's been fought, because we then had to go back once we had the CPO, which was August 24, and get everybody to sign up again, you know, it's taken 8 years. I mean, I had Aaron all sorts when we started doing this one. And Stephen Myroff did as well. And yes, I understand that it's taken a long time, I understand the frustration, and that's driven in cost. And my point, and I'm quite happy to be quoted on this, and the legal team will be, this could have all been avoided 5 or 6 years ago. And I am disappointed the manufacturers all of a sudden, you know, may want to settle if that's where we end up. They should have done it 5 or 6 years ago. They'd have given money to people then, and it'd have given more money than they're going to get now, because everyone's costs have got to come out of this. So it is ongoing. I'm glad nobody can see it's gone. It's not being forgotten about. Anybody who signed up to the cartel gets a monthly update, you know, and I expect it to be settled in the next 12 months. It can take up to a further 12 months for people to get the money. This is a process called disbursement. And that'll either be a settlement where we agree sitting around the table, and those conversations could well be in process this moment in time. I would never comment on that. Or we go to court, and then it's a judgment. Okay, so I 95% settle out of court, and I hope this one is one of those 95%. If that answers the question.
Yeah, it does. What's the RHA doing for its members about the forthcoming Vecto demands? The cost of trucks would inevitably rise as manufacturers struggle to meet the standards, which will impact RHA members.
Okay, so it's one of our, if you look at our six priorities, we have net zero and decarbonisation. It's one of our boxes, yeah. And all this sits within there underneath there. This is about, to answer your question in short, we are making constant representations of the government. We produce a number of reports around this about the impact and about the steps we need to go. And we are working with the industry, other trade associations. It's very important. Not just Logistics UK. Everybody thinks ourselves and Logistics UK are like Liverpool, Everton, or Man United and Man City. We're not actually. You know, not now. It's about collaboration. We're working with the cold chain, we're working with the chemical association, because it affects everybody, because it's a truck. And we need a roadmap, and we need a plan. From a cost and price perspective, I have a belief, and we'll watch this space, in the next 6 to 12, 8 months, I think there'll be significant movement in the pricing around vehicles, you know, because there's been a lot of money invested on both sides. It's not just operators, you know, it's the people that's producing these vehicles. And everybody needs a plan to move to an end position. And this one at this moment in time, which is why consultations or around diesel phase out or whatever it may be are so very, very relevant. Does that answer the question?
So, yeah. I keep being told electric trucks are the future, but they don't work for my operation. Why does it still feel like the message is electric or nothing? Is the RHA pushing back strongly enough on behalf of operators who simply can't make the numbers work?
Yeah. No, we've got a... Again, I'll give you an example of what we do by stealth, probably. We've got a forum on the 10th of March. So this is 60 leaders of the industry. So we've got operators in there. We've got the big ones, the middle ones, the small ones. We've got, for example, Voltempo, so the manufacturers of the industry. We've got Renault coming along to talk about what they're doing from a truck perspective. We've got DFT and DBT sat in the room listening. And I invite, we do this every 12 weeks, talk about a specific topic. And I invite DFT to come and listen to the mood of the industry. You know, so we'll have senior officials listen to it. And we're actually talking about lessons learned from the road to net zero. Okay. And it's press out aloud. It's chat mouse riddle. Sorry. And two of the speakers, we've got 15 speakers on three panels. And they all get 5 minutes to answer one question. And the question is, since 2019, which is when the legislation was laid for the phase out of the diesel engines, what lessons have we learned? And what does the future look like optimistically for the industry from your perspective? Okay. So we've got people like Alex Knowles coming. Okay, we've got Maritime, Tom from Maritime is coming. People that are in the Z-Head trial, for example. We've got Dr. Lisa Whitty from British Gas coming to talk about hydrogen. We've got JCB coming to talk about hydrogen cell. So our position is very clear on this. It won't be one size fits all. And we can still see, against the current timelines, in 2050, the requirement for diesel in certain industries. You know, things like forestry, things like agri, you know, things like tippers, things like what... You know, Dave Collett and Sam and the guys do up at college, moving the big stuff around the country. That's not going to be battery electric anytime soon, if at all. So we have to be realistic and pragmatic. My belief is if we're going to start somewhere, you should find an area where it works, battery electric, and see it working really well, and that'll give the industry a balanced view. And I actually think that's Power Networks. I could say so. You know, you think about that. You can run a pilot network on all your vehicles being battery electric. I know members that do. I know members of the industry and members of the RHA. You know, and we should really be serious about it, but it's a really fair question. If I look outside in, you know, I would get that. And I think part of it is because the only solution for cars is electric, and it works well. It's more effective for cars, but we have to be careful because the van's going to cut in the middle. You know, I mentioned the 4.25 ton van I've got now with a battery in it. It used to be a 3.7, you know. That's going to get caught in the middle. I can't charge it anywhere. So it's bigger than the car charging space.
Yeah.
Because it's 10% longer, 15% wider. I block all the McDonald's and Starbucks up. You know, so we've really got to start to challenge in a positive way. Just to close on it, I mean, I was asked, and I've been challenged actually by quite a few electric battery manufacturers that, you know, the RHA is negative towards battery. We're not. Now, I believe we should have a direction of travel and let's all get behind battery and see why it doesn't work. But actually I accept it's not going to work in certain cases and find an alternative and not just be blinkered. Does that make sense?
It does. And you've got an electric car yourself, haven't you?
I have. Oh, yes. Great. Lovely car. iX3. And there's three reasons why I bought the car. That's untrue, actually. There's three reasons why I got the car. And I've had it for 2 years. And I'll travel 35,000 miles a year, you know what I mean, in my car. And I use it, you know, it's my office. It's where I go. I got it because... Very kindly, the RHA provides me with a car when it's not my money. Because it's an unproven technology, there's no second-hand market, and I don't know what that battery's going to do in 5 years' time. So I got it because I didn't have to pay for it directly. The second reason I got it is I wanted to test this range anxiety that everybody talks about. So my car will do 200 miles when it needs to charge. The closest I've had it down to 10 miles, where it was going around. Oh, everything was flashing, it was quiet. It was a bit like coming down in Apollo 13, or how I would imagine that to be, you know? And I had to find the charging station. But I wanted to test that range anxiety. And, you know, I go to Scotland, going there next week. It's an extra 2 hours on my trip. But it's not just about the trip, it's about what you're doing the next day as well. And then the third reason, because I've run many transport operations and truck operations, I understand, and I used to be a planner. The best job I ever had in the industry was planning vehicles. I used to love it. So I understand it. And it would not work because you cannot charge it quick enough, you can't turn it around. The last role I had was running 350 vehicles as a fleet, and we used to have a truck utilisation over a 24-hour period of 85%. The only time the vehicle stood was when the driver was shaking hands and checking it. That's what this industry runs on. It's low mileage, got to go. Battery electric at this moment in time. Less than 1,000 battery electric trucks out of 500,000 in this country, I believe. Yeah, the infrastructure's not in place. It's cost prohibitive. And I believe the range is okay now. But the industry needs to change to adapt to it as well. It's not. I think everyone gets lost on that. It's the movement of freight around this country needs to really start to change. And our expectation of what it's going to be if we're actually really going to adopt this technology to help it on this work. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, it does. I've got a lighter question here. You just said about your cars, your office, but you're not working all the time. No. This person asks what you actually do to relax. What was the last thing you binge-watched or read that had nothing to do with trucks?
I don't watch telly. I'm one of these growing... It's this generational thing. I must be getting younger. Apparently, YouTube is the thing to watch. So you can pick what you want to watch, when you watch, and where you go. So I watch a lot of YouTube. And the sort of things... It's kind of related. The thing I'm interested in is this van life. These people that live in a van. And they just drive everywhere. To me, it's great that, you know,
off the grid.
Yeah, yeah, and off the go. And they've got little, you know, there's the solar panels. And then it's a great, great way to live to a point. And then I think, well, maybe it's not, actually. In terms of other stuff I'd watch on telly, there's certain bands that I used to work with, actually, that I follow. So I'll always watch, you know, see what they're up to and everything else. And the news. If anything else, I'll just have the news on because one is I've always found it interesting. You can't beat a good bit of breaking news, as we've seen this morning, Will.
Yep.
And two is it keeps me informed from your job, so I guess that's working. And then from what do I read?
Commercial motor, of course.
No, apart from, you said not related to the industry.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
I do read commercial motor and motor transport. I go there, actually, if I want to know what's anything about trucks and what's going on, and to see if you've mentioned that. No. I will... read only factual books, so I love history. And the book I'm reading at this moment in time is Winston Churchill's memoirs.
Oh yeah, nice.
It's fantastic. So it's many volumes of them, but I'm getting through it.
Yeah,
it's good.
Fantastic. Okay, back to work. How can operators be expected to comply with drivers' hours rules when decent truck parking is so hard to find?
This takes me back to running fleets, because I used to sit there many times when it was a unionised environment I used to work with, and have conversations with the full-time official and the reps about how can you expect a driver to take a break and discharge his duties in that area. And the answer is, I don't have an answer for that. I think a pragmatism has to exist. And I always used to appreciate the pragmatic view that the drivers showed when they were struggling to park somewhere. I do think there's an element as well, going back to my point about being a professional driver. Professional drivers will be able to find somewhere to park 9 times out of 10, should the road conditions allow to, if they plan their journeys and use their knowledge and skill and expertise correctly. There are quite a few, I'm not saying they're not professional drivers, but drivers that probably just look at it, I'm driving from there to there, the sat nav will tell me when to stop and where to go, or the program, but actually you do need to intervene in that, you know? And so I can't really answer that question other than to say, you know, we appreciate the support of the drivers in this. You know, we should never park somewhere that's not safe, you know, and you should never expect a driver to run the length of a shift, you know, that puts them in that position, frankly. Yeah. I always used to, you know, one of the things I used to do when I was a planner, although this is going back 35 years, when they used to have pencils and pieces of paper and rubbers and rulers, and used to be able to smoke at the desk because you smoke, I used to plan in the brakes, you know, so I'd know where they'd be. Because you didn't have trackers on vehicles. They didn't have phones in the cab. It was CB radios. They used to have 10p's to go and make a phone call or go to the police station. They used to have people in police stations where you could go in and say, can you use the phone? Yeah. Never mind. So all that is this generational change stuff. But I think sometimes you need to go back to that basics, you know. So it's like today, it's a fabulous truck stop, you know, is this one. It's a lovely breakfast. So if I'm driving about, you know, I'm going to be saying, you know what, and I'm going up and down, I'm going to be there for my breakfast on a Monday, all right, because you know it's here. So I think that's probably the best answer I can give to that.
Yeah, if you could point to one bit of infrastructure investment the industry desperately needs, what would it be?
You know, everyone will go straight to the Lower Thames Crossing, you know, because that's an obvious one, you know, because it does. It is different. I mean, the Dartford Tunnel, yeah, oh dear, dear, dear. So it's got to be that, if you might say. But it's always a difficult question. I mean, I think the A66 upgrade, you know, that's fundamental. All these things were campaigned on and everything else. It's the one that we're not talking about is the one that we desperately need, because it's not an issue at this moment in time, if that makes sense. It'd be nice to get to that point where we're actually future planning, not reacting. So that's not the reason the Lower Thames has come in is because you can't get certain times of day, you can't move, you know, and it's driving. We estimate that £30 billion worth of cost is driven into the economy every year because of congestion. Okay, so that's cost driven into our members and the industry as hauliers and operators, but also cost driven into manufacturers and commercial entities waiting for the goods or not being able to get the goods. Now, that'd build a nice few roads, you know, but to get there, it's a chicken and egg, and I understand that. But, you know, we spend a lot of time HS2 and talking about rail and flicking from road to rail. I would love to move 10% off the road and put it on rail, you know, because that would allow the congestion in this country to subside a little and free a better movement, as long as we control and restrict it. I'm a great believer that we should intervene in the movement of vehicles around this country at certain times, you know, because we've learned in London it works. We might not like it, but it works, you know. So why wouldn't we do that more appropriately? I'm not suggesting we make exactly what was London. There's certain times where motorways or certain parts of motorways can only be used by SUVs or, you know, cars or whatever it may be to actually free up those bottlenecks. And I think we're going to have to get into that position because of the number of vehicles on the road, if that answers the question.
Okay. What's the RHA doing about potholes? We're past the repair stage now. Total resurfacing is a priority.
Yeah, funny enough, I was talking to, again, going back to collaboration, which is something that, you know, if there was a question, I'm not trying to ask myself questions on this, that you to ask me about one of the things that I'm proud of doing at the RHA is to drive collaboration. And I think we're recognised as that. You know, one of our pillars and one of our values is collaboration. And I was talking to the Road Surfacing Trade Association. It's amazing, amazing. I'm also the chair of TAF. So TAF is the Trade Association Forum. So I chair that. It's a non-exec role. And the reason why I took that role on was to learn about trade associations. So 4 years ago, I could run an operation. You know, I could run and make money for people. I won the Motor Transport Award for the Chilled Network. Very proud of that. But I didn't know anything about trade associations. So I wanted to go and join a trade association to speak to other me's to understand what you did, which is one of the reasons that I said earlier to one of the questions, think about what a trade association does other than gives you a financial return. It gives you that network. But anyway, go back to that. And the Road Surfacing Trade Association is exactly what you've just said. The roads, motorways, were built within 10, 15 years of each other, so they're all falling to bits at the same time.
Yeah.
There is a cheaper way, and I don't know the detail, resurfacing is cheaper than filling in. Facts, if you do it a certain way. So we're obviously championing and campaigning and supporting across other trade bodies to get the filling in process to keep the country moving. But the longer term sits within our infrastructure and our infrastructure campaign that we actually need to look at, you know, resurfacing and re-engineering some of our existing roads, because in 10 years' time they'll fall to pieces, to answer the question directly. So we're on with the potholes, it's short-term fix, it is only short-term fix, we need to rebuild the roads.
But on the subject of collaboration, this person says, has the OHA ever thought of collaborating with other road users, such as the AA, RAC, caravans, campers, cyclists, motorcyclists, coach companies, to lobby for a safe and fit-for-purpose road network with a half-metre verge safe runoff? The times I've seen expensive mirrors at the sides of the road is beyond counting.
Okay, that specific question in terms of that runoff, we're not currently lobbying and campaigning on that, but I'll go and have a look at that. But going back to the actual, we do engage with all of the above, you know, or it be through the work Transport Focus does and all, you know, we are regularly in touch with the RAC and the AA and other road group users, you know, cyclists especially, you know, particularly, again, the DVS work that we did, you know, and we are very mindful, particularly in formulating policies, to engage with those road user groups as well. One is not to cut, so we're not cutting across anything they're working on, but also to understand it from their perspective, you know, because it's no secret that, you know, cyclists, you know, are very vulnerable to a big truck, to a little truck and to a car. So we have to understand if we're going to be banging on and campaigning on certain things that we are not potentially saying we want to endanger that group of road users' lives, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So about that specific question, I'll look into that.
Yeah, I think he was talking about like protruding branches.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it's again, it comes down to the challenge we've got in this country that roads just seem to be forgotten about. And there's no secret, and I make this point to DFT, that if you look at DFT's top five priorities, you know, trucks are in it. It's buses, it's trains. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. But, you know, there is a sense that we just need to push up that agenda. It's not sense. We need to get up that agenda.
Yeah.
You know, and I always tell this story, and it's true, and I always caveat it. You know, during the COVID, rightly so, everybody stood at the Thursday afternoon, first tea time, and applauded the NHS. There's nobody clapping truck drivers and the people supporting them and the infrastructure, you know, and there should have been, because that wouldn't have happened without that.
Yeah.
There's other sectors as well, but it wasn't even recognised, which is why we did the HGB Heroes campaign afterwards, and I know other trade bodies did similar things. We're just invisible, an invisible industry. But whenever there's a shortage of drivers, which there was a number of years ago, you know, everyone rushes down and buys toilet roll and potatoes and beans, and then all of a sudden we're a priority. It's finding that consistency, which I think is a sentiment that most of the questions you've asked me this morning, actually.
Yeah. You just touched on the driver shortage. So that's getting better, is it?
No.
And how do we solve it long term?
So I think I've just been doing some work across Europe, because I'm a great believer is to understand where we sit against other countries, you know, and what they do. And the driver shortage, as we would call it, is a global issue. So there are less people in the generations, the two youngest generations coming into the workplace that want to drive trucks. Okay. And it's not because, I mean, part of it will be because of the standard of the infrastructure in some countries. It's not because of the wages particularly, because it's quite a well-paid job. I'd suggest driving a truck compared to certain when I started, you know, in comparisons to other sectors. You know? It's that they don't want to work more than 8 hours, and they want flexibility in start times, finish times, and days of the week working. That is not this industry. So the intergenerational changes is something. We've just done a piece of work with Women in Transport on this, and it basically says, you know, the two youngest generations don't want to do what I've just described, but we need to change our entry levels to attract them in and accept that they're going to move every couple of years. Yeah. So being a driver for 35 years, probably. I'm not saying there won't be people that do that, but it'll be a less number. Just look at the numbers where we sit today, Will, in this country. So there's 550,000 drivers with vocational licenses. There's 550,000 trucks, give or take. Yeah. At the last reiteration of driver CPC, we lost 110,000 drivers. Yeah, we lost 110,000. That happens again in 5 years' time, and we currently need 60,000 drivers a year to stand still. The boot camps have gone, and they've been devolved now to Metro Mayors to make a decision if they want to invest that money in them.
Yeah.
Out of the 13 devolved areas, there's only three that prioritises logistics. So I would suggest there's not going to be a lot of boot camping going on. So it's now down to the industry to bring in, you know, but the apprenticeship levy provides challenges in terms of accuracy, we know. So this is not scaremongering at all. We have to be pragmatic and say this is not a job that people will be doing as much as in 20, 30, 40 years' time. So my challenge to government and the RHAs is, you know that, so let's plan for it. Let's plan for it. You know, it's a profession, it's a skill, there'll still be truck drivers, the RHA will still be here, Logistics UK will still be all of that, but let's plan how we're going to make sure that we can enjoy a fabulous breakfast like that, or our descendants get in 30 years' time. Because we won't be doing. So it's a global issue, and nobody's got the answer to the question, apart from we need to look at changing how we move product and the times around this country, which goes back to my point about restricting movements to free up movements. So if you can take what is a 12-hour run today and actually make it a 6-hour run because you're not queuing all the time, you may well get that generation to pop in and do that. And it might be that lowering the entry level, well, you can't really particularly do that, I'd suggest, on licence acquisition for a class one, but you can for a class two, sorry, old-fashioned word. So we might have more 18 tons rolling about, which actually, if you look at the industry, it's moving towards that to some degree, yeah? So the big stuff trunking depot to depot, and then it's a radial of the smaller trucks taking it out.
Yeah, okay. So is driverless trucks, are they the answer, or is that a non-starter?
Driverless trucks, as you are more the expert on this than I am, Will. Driverless trucks operate in America.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do work. Coast to coast, big space, you know, on the old highway, freeway, whatever way. So it works, you know. Come back to that point of infrastructure over here. Okay, we can't, the current infrastructure can't support the 44-ton person-driven truck at this moment in time. Platooning, I think there's a place for that. And I think they should probably look at trialling that. I'll try to trial it again in specific areas. You know, and just for clarity, when I use the expression platooning, I mean, you've got the guy at the front who's got three or four following him, and he's in control of all three or four. Yeah. Create a road train. If you go to Australia, where there's also a driver shortage, and you look at the size of some of them things that move around with sheep in the back of them, you know, they don't bother with the platooning, just look it all up and off it goes, and you can't lie, you know, it's fantastic. So why not consider things like that to move the freight at certain times of day when it's going DC to DC? You know, and I know that from the old network planning days, you know. You know, we used to have a good network, we'll always have a depot 4.5 hours. So that's where the driver goes. And you don't have to worry about truck stops and everything else. Is that the world we're going to move into? I don't know. I'd like to think so.
Right, last few questions now. Well, what's the best thing about the industry that people outside it never see?
The people. You know, people. Absolutely, the people. You know, it's the reason I do what I've done and I enjoy this industry is people. You know, and I enjoy, the people say about this industry, there's no entrepreneurs. Oh, they are. There's a lot of entrepreneurs in this industry. There's a lot of resilient people, a lot of passionate people, and there's people that love what they do and want to improve the country. And I just think that's commendable, more so than any other industry that I've experienced.
What's one thing operators or drivers would be surprised to learn about what the RHA actually does?
We've got a benevolent fund. And this is the best...
A benevolent fund.
Best kept secret in the industry. And we got... I'm not going to say exactly how much money. We got a significant amount of money in the benevolent fund. And we opened it up to the industry a couple of years ago. It's not just RHAX members, it's the industry. And we're starting to see an uptake on it. And I'm really proud of benevolent fund. And that's... Just to give you an idea, people can apply for that works in the industry to help them in times of need. And I know we're all proud people, and this industry is full of proud people. That's another thing I like about it. So much pride in this industry. And it's a difficult thing. It's a difficult word to say, it's benevolent. Not pronunciation, but it's a difficult thing to go and ask for help. And I get that. And particularly in certain parts of the industry that are male-dominated, because blokes don't talk about issues and ask for help, you know. But if you need it, go to it, because, you know, we'll get anything from a mobility scooter to paying bills for a period of time to ease or to deal with challenging times when people pass away. And, you know, that the money that we make from some of the events we do goes straight into it. Our members kindly contribute towards it as part of their annual fee. Use it. It's there for the industry. You know, I won't be paying out more than what's going into it. I want it to be nearly going bust, and it's not. It's nowhere near it. So that the benevolent fund without doubt.
No, well, I certainly hadn't heard of that.
Oh, yeah. It's massive. Got it for 25 years, you know, it's, and, yeah.
Excellent. What was the most satisfying win you've had in this job that most members probably don't even know about?
There's probably three. I'm going to go three on this. One is the CPO for the truck cartel. Yeah, and that was the first time it had been granted, and people said, well, do it. And believe me, the manufacturers have fought us hard on it. And that's why I was brought to the RHA to do it, so that was good. Enjoyed that. Specifically about the RHA as an organisation, as an employer and as a business, was winning the Times Award for employer for the second year on bounce. So we were Times accredited. Well, that was really pleasing because, you know, we spend a lot of time, particularly Claire, who's me, head of HR, investing in the culture and training, because the only asset I've got is people. I don't have trucks. You know, I have buildings that I own, but, you know, and my payroll's just under £6.5 million a year. You know, so it's a big thing. From an industry perspective, just to one throw as DVS, you know, I thought that was really good because we took a situation that was out of control. You know, we had the academics saying, well, this is what you need to do. The industry saying, we don't really know what it is. You know, and yet the larger operators in industry saying, well, we're okay because we've already got it on the trucks that are coming out. You know, but we actually stopped that, paused that, and it's implemented it well. And we've all learned from it. You know, so I think probably the DVS could be the 50 mile an hour in Scotland as well, because we campaigned long enough on that.
Yeah, I think you've answered this last question then, which was, when you leave this role, what would you want operators like me to say you actually changed?
I think the word change is probably wrong. Is evolved. You know, I'd like people to think the RHA is future proofed and is continuing to support the industry going forward. So what have I changed in that? Is the one single thing, as in a trade association, land as I call it, is, and I'm passionate about this, is we've changed the way we collaborate now. We don't, you know, if you want to be a member of the RHA, I'm very happy to see you. If you want to leave and go and join Logistics UK, it's right for your business. I'm not going to encourage you. I'm not going to stop you doing it. But you can be in both, or you can be in cold chain. So it's really that collaborative piece. And, you know, my job is to make sure that the RHA supports the industry on a day-to-day basis operationally, but also makes the key stakeholders that are not just government, and that's the other thing, there's a lot more key stakeholders, you know, not just government. I mean, I was talking to Amazon last week, you know, who are members of the RHA, about certain things which are not directly truck related, but they will impact the industry in 2 or 3 years time, you know. So it's that we became far broader as well. You know, said to me, what would my legacy be, that we became relevant, because that's one of our values, and stayed relevant, which I think we are.
And how long are you planning to stay in the job, and what will you do next?
So I'm going to stay in the job until 2030. You know, I've got another chairman and a bit to go. And we're currently putting, I mean, unless it all goes wrong, and it could be like, you know, 2030 tomorrow morning, I'm going to stay in the job until. And I'm very real to that fact, because, you know, my job is, whilst it's not an elected position, you know, it's leading the trade association. Yes, there's a big commercial responsibility to it, but there's also a big industry responsibility. So 2030, we're building the team now to continue and develop, to basically make me redundant, you know, and my role and what I do. And I've got a really good team around me at this moment in time, and it'll develop, and I'm pleased with the people that have joined. And then I'm going to, I bought a field, which is not a secret.
An acre field,
very expensive. Yeah, 2 miles from where I live. And I'm just currently saving up to build a fence to put around it that's dog proof. Giving you a clue now. And then the last 2 years, savings will go towards building a structure, which is basically a 10-kennel facility, you know, state-of-the-art with all the bits in, and I'm going to run a small, privately-owned dog sanctuary. So I've got 5 rescue dogs, and that's myself and my wife's passion, you know, and that's what I'm going to do.
Oh, that sounds really good.
I look forward to it. I'll invite you along. We can do it there.
Excellent. Richard, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much, Will. Enjoy the breakfast. Enjoy the conversation. Thank you.
Cheers.